Morning, everyone. Thanks for your interest in Quanta today. We're the largest specialty contractor in the United States. As we stand here, our key takeaways, if you will, are primarily that 85% of what we do, we self-perform. We think that distinguishes us in the market. From our end, the biggest thing from a construction standpoint is the execution risk. To the extent that we self-perform, we think that the aspect of 85% of that is under our direct control, we think that distinguishes us. The other thing is that as we think about our year-to-year spend from our customers, we look at that as very programmatic spend, and that's very different. A lot of people think about what we capture as project-based, and although there are definitely project nature of what we do, from our standpoint, it's much more about the programmatic spend of our customers. To that end, about 60% of our revenues is electric power, and about 40% of our revenues comes from our pipeline and industrial group. When you re-look at that across the type of customers that we have, about 60%-65% of our revenues come from utility customers. We think that that is something that is important for investors to be thinking about when we're trying to get a sense of what that repeatable, sustainable spend is like. When you think about that programmatic spend coming from such a large utility base, that's what gives us the visibility to the multi-year spend programs and gives us confidence in our aspect of growth. When we think about growth, we largely break our revenues down into what we consider to be base business and larger projects. Larger projects for us are projects that are over $100 million in electric power, technically $75 million in the pipeline group, but let's just say on average about $100 million. Then everything below that, we consider to be base business. Everything below that portion of our revenues is about 85% of the revenue base that we have today. For our electric power and our pipeline groups combined on that base business, we look out and see a mid-single to upper single and even double-digit type CAGR opportunities. That's what we look at least for the next 3 years, is the way we see things. You can go back and you can see that CAGR. You can see us having produced a double-digit type CAGR now for quite some time. In fact, if you go all the way back to about 2010, our top-line CAGR is over double digits. When we look forward, we continue to see that in the base business, with large projects giving opportunities still yet above that. There's going to be some movement in the way that large projects flow, and that creates some individual period-to-period bounce. But for the most part, that base business, which is the largest portion of what we do, we continue to see a mid-single to double-digit type opportunity. So that's a quick overview. To that end, I'll answer any questions you got.
Perfect. Thanks. I mean, I know the sentiment on broader E&C can be tough. So can you kind of point to a few things, whether it's your construction-led self-perform, that kind of sets you apart from the broader group as the market views it?
Yeah. So our primary focus is craft-skilled labor. Day in and day out, we think about the people that it takes to actually execute the work that is out there. As it stands here today, in the third quarter, we had 46,000 people. And we are focused on how we deploy those resources. When we said earlier, we talked about 85% of our work is self-performed. Well, we focus on the development and training and the safety of all of those people. And in our mind, the best way to control risk of the project is as close to the project as possible. And to that end, when you're controlling and dealing with the labor directly in such a high concentration labor, that's what gives you that visibility into the workflows, etc. I think the other thing that's distinctive is the way that we have focused on people is on the training and development side of the equation. In the last 5 to 6 years, we've spent $100 million incremental dollars specific and unique to the training and development of people. We have an annual spend that goes on regularly, but that $100 million incremental dollars, and a great example of that is our acquisition of Northwest Lineman College. We acquired an accredited college that is very focused on the development of people. We looked at the dynamic of the youth coming into this industry and the importance of training that youth in a way that they are receptive to. Going about it the way that it has been done for 50 years, you know, may not necessarily work anymore. And what we were focused on is that how do we ensure that we're bringing people into the equation, that we were recruiting them from a standpoint of what they could feel connected to, and then still yet how do we train them unique to the means, instead of 8 hours in a classroom, you know, this is focused on getting them 15 minutes, 20 minutes in classroom, and then all outside, hands-on training, et cetera. That accredited focusing on the developers themselves, the trainers themselves, they're the ones that are actually going out there and doing that versus that training falling on us. That distinction is significant because we've been able to increase the number of people coming into that college. We've been able to, with our investment in them, they've quadrupled the enrollment that's coming into the college, and that's giving us even more and more opportunity for the development of people, as well as bringing our training of our resources that we were already doing within Quanta up to better standards, because we're allowing them to train our trainers on how to better interact with new linemen.
I'll turn it over to you guys if there's any questions in the audience. If not, I'll keep on going. Can you talk about the visibility that you have going into next year? You had a pipeline project that's got delayed a little bit. You have utility spends that are, you know, you can see for multiple years what they're planning on. So just kind of in general, the level of comfort headed into 2020 kind of versus years in the past.
So as we stand here today, we feel comfortable talking about 2020 having growth in our consolidated revenues. We speak to it on a consolidated basis versus the individual segments right now is because we want to see kind of how the next 3 or 4 months shape up relative to backlog awards, et cetera. But it doesn't stop us from being very confident in our ability to grow at the top line level. Now, that's growth in consolidated revenues, operating income, EBITDA, and EPS. We feel very comfortable in talking about the aspect of the growth of those areas. When it comes down to how we separate that into the segments right now, we're just a little bit hesitant to get into that much detail. I mean, there's a lot of movement that can still yet happen, in the example with what's happening with large projects. So we want to see how that shapes up a little bit before we get granular. But when we think about those continued tailwinds that we've talked about on those programmatic spend, as we go forward and how that plays into our base business growth, we have every bit of confidence of, as we think about going forward, that next year, let alone the next few years, we'll still yet have that growth. And to that end, we think that it will translate at a consolidated level as growth from 19 into 20.
And on the pipeline side, thanks.
Well, I mean, like I said, we're speaking on a consolidated. The pipeline side, you know, the aspect of it, you know, that base business, without a doubt. The large diameter pipe, you know, that's a cyclical business. And, you know, the timing of those individual awards and as those projects move forward, you know, is a big deal. As an example of one project you're making reference to, ACP, you know, as to exactly how it's going to play out in 2020, we haven't determined that yet. Mm-hmm. And so we'll want to see visibility into that before we get into that level of granularity. But it doesn't change our view that the base business continues to be strong and that we'll have the consolidated growth.
Just a comment on that, if the AC does not get started again and the pipeline is not up, could you still grow the whole company?
We feel comfortable in consolidated growth despite those efforts, or despite those issues.
A little more color on the whole West Coast utilities. I know PG&E is a big customer. I think it's less than 10, but I think it's close to 10.
At this stage, it's over 10%.
Is it over 10?
Yes.
I think that would be a huge opportunity long term. I know your CEO talked about the entire West Coast, but just in the PG&E is such a big piece of California. Can you touch a little on that and the opportunity is?
Sure. Well, we do speak largely to, you know, the broader aspect of Western U.S. versus just the individual customer dynamic. I would tell you that I think that Duke's commentary for the Western U.S. is applicable directly to the individual customer dynamic that you're speaking to. But look, I mean, we've mobilized a lot of resources out there, and we think that we're first of all focused on the safety of the people, our own employees, and the amount of work that needs to still yet occur. There is a substantial amount of work that we believe exists near term, mid term, and even long term. There's we related so much to what happened in the East Coast with the storm hardening that came through the East that went on for a decade, and we look at that type of dynamic still yet there in the West, not unique to that customer. there is a substantial amount of work that we believe that should be done in the West, or that our customers are leaning into to deal with that fire hardening aspect of it that can be concentrated in those individual customers. But I don't believe that it's also just isolated to a California type situation. It is mainly those individual Western states. We think that, from the customer commentary, there's a lot of customer commentary about there being billions of dollars to spend that needs to be dealt with over the next 3 to 5 years. And we think that we are positioned well to be a good participant with that.
And just with respect to the bankruptcy, you have some receivables that are reclassified long term. I mean, is there a risk that depending on the bankruptcy comes out, you guys take a hit on cash worth that?
We have about 8 million, I believe, is the number that we've classified as non-current asset. We still feel very comfortable with the position of that. I think that there's customer communications that are out that they believe that they can come out in 2020 vendors will be at 100% payment plus interest. You know, so they've said that publicly. We're watching it. We're paying very close attention to it. But at this stage, we feel very comfortable with our position.
Can you talk about the Watte project that was just awarded back in August time?
Yeah, I mean, we had it physically was awarded to us a little bit sooner than that, but we got to full completion of and regular and financial close here in the fourth quarter. So to that end, it is not reflected in our September 30 backlog. It would be incremental and now reflected in our year-end backlog. Our backlog was at record levels, both 12-month and total at September, and so we believe that this would be a nice award to see it push us into continued record levels at year-end. Great project. I think that it continues to reflect our capabilities in large project-type dynamics and the confidence in that market and our abilities. That project will effectively start here about the first quarter of 2020. It's a longer-term project. You'll see that come into its contributions into 2021, 22. So it doesn't create some substantial individual spikes because it's got a number of years to roll out. But it gives us a good combination with that and the East-West project. You know, gives us a very good base of revenues up there. That should allow for the Canadian market has created a little bit of headwind at this time because we've got the ins and outs of the flows of the project has created some margin pressure in Canada because of our fixed costs as you wait to get that deployed on some of these larger projects. So you saw that a little bit in the second, a little bit in the third, even a little bit there in the fourth on the electric power side. The larger aspect of that revenue contribution coming through in 20 between the combination of those projects will create fixed cost absorption, better utilization of our overall resources, and create less of a margin headwind. We feel very comfortable in our ability to execute on those projects such that, when we talk about a double-digit operating margin profile for the electric power segment, we think that these projects can be very complementary to that. At the beginning, you should expect that we'll have some degree of prudency in our revenue recognition. There are going to be a large amount of contingencies on a project like that, and we'll want to see ourselves execute through those contingencies, which would give us more of a back-end opportunity for a lift. But on the front end, I would expect us to be fairly prudent in how we think about the margin contribution.
Got it. So you guys have a handful of large electric T&D projects going on now, but it still pales in comparison to what five, 10 years ago when you guys could have had up to what, 10 or 12 at a time, and now it's probably more like 3?
That's about right, yeah.
Okay. And so the longer-term outlook for that piece of the business is low double-digit EBIT margins, right? And we're kind of at 8.5 now.
For electric power?
For electric power.
Well, we feel very confident in our ability in electric power to operate at double digits. And, so to kind of give it some color, our U.S. market today, electric power is operating in double digits. So when the 8% reference we're making there is that, yes, we have guided to kind of an 8 handle overall for 2019. So to color that, one, our telecommunications operations are embedded within electric power. And right now those telecommunications are about $400 million of revenue contribution for the year. That effort is more of a greenfield effort, and so you know, we're growing that base. And when you're growing that, you've got a fixed cost component, and we're having to overcome that. And what we've seen is that on the U.S. market for telecom, we've seen margin growth sequentially for each of the last, you know, 6-7 quarters, such that as we stand here in the third quarter, we had mid-single to upper single digits, and we think we can exit the year, such as the fourth quarter, with upper single to even double-digit opportunity for the telecom group. But that means that overall for the year, you're probably mid-single digits. That's creating dilution against our 10% goal, that 10% electric power being diluted somewhat by the impact of telecom. Telecom in 2020, we continue to see the ability to operate in an upper single digit, even double digit profile for 20. So the dilution will either be muted or won't be there. You know, we may be able to see that it's on par with what we see from an electric power perspective. In addition to that, specific to 2019 was the Peru project that we had talked about there in the second quarter. That's a $79 million impact. That's a 110 basis point impact to 2019 results for electric power. So that, you know, call it 8.3, 8.5 type handle, you would add 110 basis points without that project. You start to see that getting up into that kind of, you know, mid to 9.5 to up type levels. But broadly, you know, our ability to execute at double digit profiles for electric power, that's something that we hold very much. Again, U.S. margins were operating a double digit for 19 for electric power. As we go forward, the Canadian market, I think, gets bolstered by exactly those larger projects we talked about. We have historically been able to operate at a very high level there, and there's nothing in our mind that changes that.
Got it. And you mentioned the Peru situation. Can you just give us the quick overview there, how it came about, and if there's been any incremental news there, you know, over the last few months?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have any specific commentary about it in the third quarter, which is because we felt like in the second quarter we had ring-fenced the issue well enough. You know, nothing has necessarily transpired. We're in the process of handing over the network, which was a contractual obligation on our side. We still think that we're well positioned, you know, relative to a recovery of the individual assets itself. You know, we have every bit of confidence that the dollars that we spent to construct the asset were spent in an appropriate way, such that we feel very comfortable in our ability to prevail, and that there wasn't an inappropriate disposition of those dollars against the asset constructed. Point being is that to the extent that we're actually in the process of handing over a physical asset, it would have been difficult on our side to have a physical asset to hand over had we not spent the dollars to build that asset. So those are the things that we're working through. There's a lot of change down there right now. That's created, you know, some dynamics, but it doesn't change our ultimate position on the contract, and we feel very comfortable we'll be able to prevail.
Got it. Can you touch upon, like, the 5G dynamic, what it could do for the telecom piece, because you guys have really only been back in that for a few years. I think it's, what you said, around $400 million or so?
Yeah, about $400 this year, yeah.
And kind of where you think that can go over time?
Yeah, so, you know, last year we had about $300 million of revenues. This year about $400 million. So when you think about that growth rate, we feel comfortable that we can continue to see clips like that as we go forward. You know, we're not targeting a specific revenue number. I mean, there's no doubt that there's substantial revenue numbers that are there. Oftentimes, we wouldn't do something like this unless we thought there was that billion-dollar type revenue opportunity. But we continue to be more focused on bringing up the margin side, and we have done that, I think, very well with continued quarter-to-quarter growth in the margin dynamic. So that's what we'll be mainly focused on, is getting the margins and being able to get that also as a repeatable, sustainable component of our business. On the 5G side, you know, clearly we're very excited about that opportunity. We think we are well positioned. There are various discussions about how carriers will ultimately deliver on their 5G. And we continue to believe that one of the primary views of that is to take advantage of existing infrastructure And that existing infrastructure, to a great extent, is the distribution grid that exists today. And we think we are very well positioned to play in that market, both because of our current customer base, utility customer base, our carrier customer base, and the fact that we play in between there, not just from the standpoint of our ability to deploy the labor, but as well as the fact that the continued dialogues we're having with people about how to approach the technology and how to effectively get that type of joint infrastructure build going on. I think we are positioned well for that dialogue. To the extent that, to remind those of you, to the extent that you're looking at having deployments on the distribution network, what's important to recognize is that that would be on the top of a distribution pole. And if it's on the top of a distribution pole, it takes a qualified journeyman lineman to cross that energized state to get to the top of that pole. It can't be done by somebody who's not a qualified journeyman lineman. So to the extent you see that type of distribution or that type of deployment, we think we're very well positioned, having this, the amount of labor that we do of qualified journeyman linemen to be able to do that work.
Got it. Switching over to the industrial infrastructure, is that what you guys call it now? The pipeline piece?
Pipeline and industrial, yeah.
The margins there last quarter they hit your longer term target at the high end, I think. The best we've seen in years. Can you talk about what drove that? I mean, is there some mix or anything kind of funny in there that we need to think about, or do you feel good about those margins?
There's nothing one time in there. I mean, all the margins that were in there were associated with the execution against our work for 2019. It was a combination, right? I mean, it really was a very good execution on our large name and work. It was very good production on our industrial side. It was very good production on our distribution side. It's all the things that we've actually been speaking to that we've been focused on now for the last 3 to 4 years to drive towards a more repeatable, sustainable EBITDA production out of that group. The third quarter is historically, one of our stronger quarters, both on the electric side and the pipeline side, when you think about the seasonality of our business. It's not uncommon for our first quarter to have a lower margin, growing into the second, growing into the third, and potentially drifting into the fourth. So regularly we execute well in the third quarter. Actually, a very good example is at the third quarter last year. Although the margin profile of the pipeline industrial group was about 7% in the third quarter of last year, embedded within that was a processing plant that we've had some issues to be dealing with, as well as one individual project that although we run into those dynamics, those two projects alone were about a 200 basis point type dynamic. So the underlying portion of the business last year was actually a 9% read through of the quarter. So it shows that we are already at a spot of being able to execute at a solid level. We're very pleased with the performance of what's happening with that group. It does speak to exactly that. I think that now it is shown. The read-through is that the margin profile is continuing to improve and is now more visible. We've got the profile for the segment for the year is about 6.2 to 6.4, which is the highest margin profile that we've seen now for the last 3 years, although it has been a growing profile. And it reflects, like I said, the efforts we've done quite a bit in the last 2 to 3 years to refocus that group on that repeatable, sustainable margin profile. Going forward, I think that we have the ability to continue to make those margins better. We're not yet in the spot to speak to exactly what we would put forward as the margin guidance for 2020, but those steps that you've seen over the last 3 years, it's our intention and our expectation that we can continue to see some of those step levels of improvement. The acquisition of Hallen is an example, and our expansion in the Northeast, we think, is an additional great example of that. So it's very much our focus on making that upper single-digit margin profile repeatable, sustainable, and very visible for that group.
Got it.
So
you know, for the most part, we don't actually think about year to year in the bid environment. And the reason being is because when we think about how much of the work we have is in the base business and that programmatic spend, the relationships we have on that utility side are such that a lot of it comes through an MSA environment, a lot of it comes through negotiated discussions, et cetera, and much less so from straight bids. So our visibility is more from the relationship side of the equation than what's happening in individual bids. Now, the bid side of the equation can come out on the larger project type dynamics, which is a smaller percentage of those overall revenues. And as we think out multi-year, we continue to look at billions of dollars of opportunity on the pipeline side as well as on the electric power side. Projects, for example, like we just talked about with East-West or the Wate. I mean, those type projects still yet exist. We think that those type projects, we are well positioned for, whether it be on electric power or on pipeline, both by reputation of, on-time delivery, delivering on budget and safely for our employees and those customers. So we think we're very well positioned. But I would tell you that we look at those markets as continue to be as strong as we've seen in recent history. There will always be a timing type dynamic to it, of course. But from the aspect of there being opportunities, we continue to see definitive opportunities on both pipeline and electric power.
Just on free cash flow, sounds like it should pick up into the 4Q, and that you saw some nice cash collections in October based on the last call. Can you just kind of talk about how you guys think about free cash flow conversion rates longer term? And how your priorities stack up to use that cash after that?
Sure. Well, I mean, you ask how I think about it. I think about it every day. But, we had a little bit of pressure here through the first 9 months. Remind everyone that, the number one draw for us of capital is the working capital of our business. In our minds, we are a growth business. 2010, 2019, we have over double-digit CAGR in our revenue growth. Revenue, when we self-perform 85% of our work, it's important to recognize that means that the first thing I do when I've deployed to a job is I make payroll. I make a lot of payroll because I perform so much of that work versus so many others that subcontract that work and may not have that cash outflow. We have that cash outflow day one. When we have that cash outflow day one, it takes us a bit to work through getting it into a position to bill. And then our customers have, 45 to 60 days to pay us. So that's what gets caught up in the working capital. And when we're growing our business at $1 billion, we started the year at $11 billion as an original estimate. We're ending the year now at $12 billion. The way to think about that is that historically, about 15% of your trailing 12-month revenues gets caught up in working capital. So if I'm growing $1 billion, then I have about $150 million draw of my working capital to support that growth. That is generally the way to think about our engine. And so if I have a revenue fall off for whatever particular point, then that's the same thing. That releases now, and then I become I have a lot more cash flow. You'll see that our cash flow can be volatile in the quarters as well as the years, largely based upon that individual flow of revenue. I manage two things, people and equipment. The largest portion of that fluctuation in cash is associated with the people side of it. Having said that, so now in 2019, we mobilized on some pretty substantial work, and a lot of that was there in the West. To that end, some of that work comes down to, amount of paper when you're mobilizing thousands of people to aggregate. And so sometimes when you have changes in those processes, the individual aggregation takes time. So that's put a little bit of pressure into that number, as well as the fact that we had a large retainage balance. That retainage balance is about $100 million has been paid there in the fourth quarter. That's what's given us a nice flow into the fourth quarter of cash. And at the same time, we're catching up on some of that paper and some of the change in the billing processes, and we see that coming down into from the end of the third into the fourth quarter, and I believe still yet being able to continue at that pace going into 2020. So I believe we can get back into a more historical kind of DSO levels. Third quarter is about 91 days of DSO. Historically, we're much closer down into an 80-day type range. I think we can start to see us trending back down towards those historical levels at the end of the year and going into 2020. What will affect my free cash flow in 2020 is going to be already what level of growth. We've talked about being able to see growth at the consolidated level. But as growth gets a bit muted, maybe from double digit as an example, if you think about growth being muted, then that releases the cash flow engine, which is why we say that, you know, in a regular everyday world, I think that we can see, you know, free cash flow conversion against EBITDA at a 40% type level. We are second to working capital. It is we are capital intensive in equipment. This year we'll have about $265 million. Next year I'm going to say it's going to be $275 to $300, something like that. So you should expect that that would create, you know, or kind of that's where we'll end up deploying capital. To me, the more relevant piece of the conversation is what do we do with our capital? And I think that when you go through and you look over the last 2 to 3 years of how we have deployed capital, we have been a we continue to be an acquisitive company. We are opportunistic in the deployment of capital against that. I think we have historically made acquisitions that are accretive to both earnings, returns, and growth, and even margins, what you've been seeing in the last little bit. So we think we have been very good at deploying capital in that opportunistic way into M&A. And then in addition, you know, the largest aspect of our deployment has been against the share repurchases. We bought $2.2 billion worth of our stock in the last little several years. And we have little pause in deploying capital to create value for shareholders, whether that be in the share buyback, dividend, or in the M&A side. And we would anticipate that to continue to be a material portion of what we think about over the next 3 to 5 years.
Several companies that I can think of over the last couple of years have gone through and done a digital transformation of how they track paperwork and people and projects and all, and have been able to shave significant working capital needs off. Is there any technology developments you see in that you can bring into the industry to bring that DSOs even down into the 70s over time? Because the volume of working capital you have, a couple of days makes a huge impact.
It does. A couple of days of DSO is substantial to us. Most of the new technologies that are actually coming out relative to working capital management, we are in the situation largely of having to follow some of our major customers' deployment of similar technology. And we have such a diverse customer base, which is a strength for us. You know, only one customer now represents 10% of our revenues. Historically, we do not have anybody that represents 10% of our revenues. So we are very diversified. What that means, though, is that we are having to deal with very diverse technologies and with such substantial customers that although they may be diverse, they are very repeating. Then it's important for us to be interacting with their technologies. And so that's half the time what drives us. When you go from 18 into 19, the discussion about some of the delays were us dealing with the adoption of new technologies at that customer and for all of us figuring out how to look at that deployment. But it's about still yet trying to improve them and us in that realm. But we can't always be the driver of that. A lot of times we're reacting to the changes of technology there.
Follow-up, if I could.
Yes.
Return on invested capital has become a much bigger emphasis among the audience investors rather than just top line or even cash flow growth.
Yes.
Are there any ROIC metrics in compensation? What's the driver? Can you talk about how you guys look at returns on invested capital?
Great question. So return on invested capital is something we talk about daily. Management put forward return on invested capital as a compensation metric on our own. The board did not, the compensation committee did not. We brought that to them. So it is a component of our long-term compensation. Our long-term compensation is the highest percentage of our total comp. For Duke, 70% of his compensation is based on long-term performance. For myself and the rest of the management team, 60% of our compensation is tied to long-term performance. And the largest portion of that long-term performance metric is return on invested capital. It is a three-year metric. We measure it over a three-year period of time. We look at it as that it takes time to turn the ship, and we believe that it should be measured as to its consistency over a multiple-year period of time. We target to be at a double-digit return. Our efforts associated with acquisitions, and our deployment of capital in other places, are to find incremental aspects and to be above a double-digit return. And very specifically, I think what you can also see is that we've had good increases in that calculation over the last several years. Yes.
We probably got time for a few more. Go ahead.
There was a panel yesterday where some commercial electric vehicle companies were talking about multiple billion-dollar spends on charging locations. Have you guys performed on a commercial-scale project of that type yet? And if so, what is that like in terms of what you're doing, what kind of equipment you're procuring? Who does the work? What kind of margin profile do you have?
As of yet, we have not done a commercial scale EV type, you know, charging station, but I do believe that over time that is a big opportunity in multiple ways. I mean, I think that it's important to come back and think about the potential impact EV deployment has on the grid, because the grid today is not necessarily situated to be able to handle that. A great example of that, when most people think about charging vehicles, they think about doing it, plugging it into the garage at night, as an example. Well, the grid as it stands today isn't necessarily designed to be able to handle that much load in an overnight type situation. Transformers, as an example, are meant to cool. They warm in the day and they cool at night when the load is decreased. Well, to the extent you look at how much of that could go through and look at electric vehicle charging at night, now you're putting that much more strain on a transformer, shortening the life of that across wherever the EV deployment is. So we look at that as being a very substantial opportunity on the grid side. On the deployment side, on the charging, I think that there's a lot of debate still yet going on as to whether it's going to be happening kind of in the local level or it's going to be happening at you know, standalone charging stations or whichever. We are looking at that and talking to various utilities about that. We are interested and think we can play in that space. But as of yet, we haven't done any major significant individual rollouts like a utility scale solar type of situation on the charging equivalent.
On the M&A front, are you guys most interested in things like you just did, Hallen, and kind of like the downstream industrial services, or where are you most interested in trying to expand?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're very opportunistic in the M&A side. Fact is that if you go through and you look over the last several years, you'll see it very mixed. I mean, having acquired a college, foundation companies, small telecom companies, an industrial services company, a distribution gas company. I mean, you see that they're actually quite varied in where they come from. And for us, that happens because that you know, a lot of times we're interested in companies that may not necessarily be for sale today. And so much of it comes down to the management teams themselves. The way that we acquire companies is to acquire somebody that, in our mind, continues to have an interest in being part of the business. Our decentralized operations, we are organized decentralized because we believe risk is best controlled as close to the field as possible. We went through that when we were talking about the employee side. And so in our model, then those target acquisitions need to be people who are still willing to be there and run those individual businesses. Finding historically good operations that through the cycle operations, people who have been there for long periods of time and the management team has been able to work through the cycle and has a continuing interest, those are all things that sometimes take time. And so you might not see. We don't target a number of dollar acquisitions in a year or particular revenues in a year or even a particular area in a year. We look at more along the lines of, do they bring something to us that we think that differentiates us to a customer, to a geography, that adds something that is distinctive to us rather than just simple capacity oftentimes. And so that can make it pretty sporadic. I'll tell you that probably one area that I don't know that we're looking to add to out of any of them is I don't really know that we would be looking to add anything in large diameter to pipe right now, but I think that you could see us be continuing to pursue opportunities in most any of the other spaces. We do think of ourselves as still yet having the ability and the desire to bring on acquisitions, though, I will say, and but we'll be selective and opportunistic about it.
Got it. Any final questions? All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it.